Srimad Bhagavatam, 5th Canto, Chapter 26, entitled The Hellish Planets, Text Number 27. So again, this verse is not, it's prose, so we're just going to read the verse. There's no meter for it.
Yetvi have dasyo Nida garda graman sarthanva vilumpanti rajano raja bhatava tamschabihi paritya yamaduta vajra damshitaha shvara sapta shatani vimshatischa sarvasam khadanti.
Word for word.
Ye,
persons. Persons who?
To,
but.
Iha,
in this life.
Ve,
indeed.
Tasyavaha,
thieves and plunderers.
Agnidaha,
who set fire.
Garadaha,
who administer poison.
Graman,
villages.
Sarthan,
the mercantile class of men.
Va,
or.
Vilumpanti,
plunder.
Rajanaha,
kings.
Raja Bhataha,
government officials.
Va,
or.
Tan,
then.
Cha,
also.
Abhi,
indeed.
He,
certainly.
Paritya,
having died.
Yamadutaha,
the assistance of Yamaraj.
Vajra damshritaha,
having mighty teeth.
Shvanaha,
dogs.
Sapta shatani,
700.
Vimshatihi,
20.
Cha,
and.
Saravasam,
voraciously.
Khadanti,
devour. Translation. In this world, some persons are professional plunderers who set fire to others' houses or administer poison to them. Also, members of the royalty or government officials sometimes plunder mercantile men by forcing them to pay income tax and by other methods. After death, such demons are put into the hell known as Sara Mayadana. On that planet, there are 720 dogs with teeth as strong as thunderbolts. Under the orders of the agents of Yamaraj, these dogs voraciously devour such sinful people. Coupled by his divine grace, Srila A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada ki. In the 12th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, it is said that in this age of Kali, everyone will be extremely disturbed by three kinds of tribulations: scarcity of rain, famine, and heavy taxation by the government. Because human beings are becoming more and more sinful, there will be a scarcity of rain, and naturally no food grains will be produced. On the plea of relieving the suffering caused by the ensuing famine, the government will impose heavy taxes, especially on the wealthy mercantile community. In this verse, the members of such a government are described as dasyu, thieves. Their main activity will be to plunder the wealth of the people. Whether a highway robber or government thief, such a man will be punished in his next life by being thrown into the hell known as Saramayadana, where he will suffer greatly from the bites of ferocious dogs.
Omagyana timirandasya gyananjana shalakaya chakshurun militamena tasmai shri gurave namaha. Shri Chaitanya Manovishtam Sthapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dharati Swapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yuta Parakavana Shri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunathan Vitam Tam Sajivam Sarvetam Savadutam Parijana Saitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakarnitam Cham. He Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dina Bandhu Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namustite Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Pancha Kalpatarubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Bhyayacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namah. Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swaminiti Namine. Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatare Shatarine. Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadha Shri Vasari Gaur Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Lokam Paroti Vashanam Pankam Nandayati Giri Yat Kripat Maham Pandi Shri Rundir Tarna. So this chapter is giving the list and the description of the various Naraka Lokas, hellish planets. And there's a total of 28 of them being listed here in the Bhagavatam. And today the one that we're hearing about, Saramayadana, is the name of this hellish planet. This is the 19th one in the list. We've done 18 so far and this is number 19. And as we've been hearing, all these different hellish planets are for specific types of sinful activities that are committed, and living entities get sent to those particular hellish planets. So this one, Saramayadana, is for plunderers. Some persons are professional plunderers who set fire to others' houses or administer poison to them. So those types of people go there. And also, the verse is saying, members of the royalty or government officials sometimes plunder mercantile men by forcing them to pay income tax and by other methods. So after death, these government officials, royalty, who are exploiting the mercantile class unduly by excessive taxation, so they also go to Saramayadana. And in that place, what happens? There are dogs. How many? 720 dogs with teeth as strong as thunderbolts. And then these dogs come and bite their flesh, and they suffer greatly in this way. So, in the purport, Srila Prabhupada is saying that in the 12th canto, it's predicted that in Kali Yuga, I mean, to some extent it's already begun. There are certain places in the world where we're already witnessing it. But one can only imagine, you know, it's only 5,000 years have elapsed and we're already starting to see these symptoms. So there's another 427,000 years remaining. So how much more extreme is this going to be? And the symptoms described here are scarcity of rain, famine, and heavy taxation by the government. So in the 12th canto, the verse that is making this prediction, it reads as follows. Harassed by famine. It's 12th canto, 2nd chapter, 9th verse. Harassed by famine and excessive taxes, people will resort to eating leaves, roots, flesh, wild honey, fruits, flowers, and seeds. Struck by drought, they will become completely ruined. When I was reading this verse, I was thinking, I was thinking, people will resort to eating leaves. Still, okay, I mean, it's not very tasty, but it's fine. Roots, okay, we have some experience. Potato is a root, still okay. And then the third one is mula misha, the word in the verses. So flesh, people actually resort to cannibalism. And it seems like a very abominable thing to think of, but it will be commonplace when that time arrives. Wild honey, fruits, flowers, and seeds. Struck by drought, so there won't be water because of the absence of rainfall. And what happens? They will become completely ruined. So what is the cause of this disturbance? Why will people suffer in this way? Or you can say, why are people already suffering in this way to some extent? In the purport, Srila Prabhupada says, he gives the explanation. He says, because human beings are becoming more and more sinful, there will be a scarcity of rain, and naturally no food grains will be produced. So there'll be drought and there'll be famine and so on. A few years ago, I was going with, I was serving in London in our temple there, and the temple president said, you know, we have a house program somewhere, so let's go. And I thought, okay, let me go along. So we were driving, and that person's house was quite close to Heathrow Airport in London. And if any of you have been through Heathrow Airport, you'll know that it's one of the busiest airports in the world. I remember that when I was leaving, I saw airplanes queuing up one after the other to take off. So very, very busy airport. And the place where we were going was very close to that airport. So we were driving on a road that was literally bordering the runway. There was only a fence in between. So as we were driving, we must have, just in the process of driving, along that road, we must have seen maybe two or three huge airplanes, Airbuses, land and take off. And it's something quite impressive when you look at it from that close. You know, normally we tend to see airplanes from very far. So when you're that close, you actually see how big this thing is. And then I remember that I was discussing with my temple president how it's quite amazing how they get such a big object. And it's not light either, it's very heavy. It's full of metal and people sitting in it with all their luggage. And somehow or other they get this thing to fly in the air. And it flies above the clouds, you know, several thousand feet, 36,000 feet. So, how is that possible, was the question we were thinking about. We were pondering, how is it possible that you can get something so heavy to fly in the air? And the outcome of our discussion on the topic was that such a thing is possible because there are people who study the laws of nature, specifically the laws of physics, the laws of movement. Shri Gaura Nithaya ki, Shri Krishna Balaram ki, Shri Radha Shyam Sundara Lalita Vishakha Devi ki. So how is such a thing possible? It's because there are people who study the laws of nature and they know how to work with the laws of nature to achieve their purpose. They don't work against the laws of nature. They work with the law of nature. They understand it and then they align whatever their purpose is with the law of nature, and then such things become possible. So intelligent persons, that's what they do. They study the laws of nature to achieve their spiritual and material purposes. An example can be given. Any of you studied physics in school? And you must have heard about aerodynamics, meaning it's the principle by which the displacement of an object can be either faster or slower depending on the amount of resistance it gets from the air. So you design an object in such a way that it can move very fast, like racing cars, Formula One. They design the cars in such a way that there's least resistance. If their car looks like a truck, it'll never win the race. It has to be something very, very efficient so that there's least resistance and it can move as fast as possible. So there are nature, the point is that in nature, there are certain laws. An intelligent person study those laws, and whatever it is that they want to achieve, they study those laws and then they act accordingly. And those who do not inform themselves about the laws of nature, they don't get the result that they desire, or they might even get the opposite of what they desire, which is suffering. So, the material nature is such that there are some laws of nature which are easy to perceive, easy to understand, easy to see. Like, for example, the law of gravity or aerodynamics. You know, it's accessible by our sense perception. But there are similarly other laws in nature that are no less real than gravity and aerodynamics and all these laws. But they may not be so easy for us to perceive. Like, for example, the law of karma. Karma is a law of nature. It is as real a law as gravity. It's real, it's a reality. But is it something that people can easily understand or easily perceive? No. Gravity, most people in the world understand. You throw a rock into the air and it's going to fall to the ground. Most people don't have any problem accepting that. But when you tell people about the law of karma, oh, they have so many doubts about this. Well, you know, okay, it's fine, it's your philosophy, and you know, we accept that, live and let live. You know, I don't necessarily accept this. So yeah, for me, I'm not entirely sure if you know, karma. I don't think karma actually is real, you know. It's fine if you believe it, but, you know, just let me live my life the way I want to live my life. Let me do what I want to do. But actually, these laws are real. They're as real as the laws that are easily perceivable. Our problem is that we, conditioned souls, tend to accept only what they can understand through their imperfect senses, what they perceive through their imperfect senses. So if something, they can observe that nature follows certain patterns with their senses, then they accept it. Okay, fine, you know, we can accept that. But if there are other laws in nature which may not be accessible to their senses, but which is accessible through the scriptures, which one can understand by study of the scriptures, so those people are more reluctant to accept, because people are not trained to accept the authority of the scriptures. And nowadays, people are only trained to accept what they can see with their senses. And we know that our senses are imperfect. But they exist, and they don't depend on your belief. The existence of laws of nature doesn't depend on your belief. One person cannot say that gravity is relative. You know, nowadays you hear that a lot in New Age philosophies, relativism, moral relativism. You know, what is true for you is not necessarily true for me. But actually, the Shastra says that's not the case. If the Shastra is saying something, it's true for everybody. It's not that somebody can say, you know, you believe in gravity, so that's great, you know. But I don't necessarily believe in that. So what I'll do is, because I'm on the third floor right now, and I don't believe in the law of gravity, so I'm not going to use the stairs or the lift. I'm just going to step out of the window, and I will very gently float to ground level. Do people say that? It's not a matter of belief. If somebody does that, they'll end up with broken limbs. So karma is the same. And why are people suffering? It's because of ignorance. The root cause of suffering is ignorance. The absence of rain and hence famine and drought and all these other miserable conditions are the result of ignorance. Ignorance of what? Of how nature works. And of what we're supposed to do while we're in this world. What is our duty? So if we undertake an analysis, a study of what... is there a law governing whether people are supplied with their basic necessities or not? Yes. Nature isn't random. Nature is functioning according to specific, well-defined patterns. There is a supreme controller who designed this, and it's functioning in a very, very well-defined way. It's not random. So, if I want to know, well, how should I live my life in such a way that I do not starve, that I get sufficient supply of the necessities of life, so what should I do? Well, Bhagavad Gita is saying, Anad bhavanti bhutani parjanyad anasambhava yagyat bhavati parjanyo yagyaha karma samudbhava. All living bodies subsist on food grains, which are produced from rains. Rains are produced by performance of yagya sacrifice, and yagya is born of prescribed duties. So a person who is very much inclined to follow the Karmakanda section of the Vedas might say, well, what is the sacrifice being spoken of here? So in other words, if you want to be supplied with the basic necessities of life, sacrifice is required. It's by the performance of sacrifice that there is sufficient rainfall. So fine. So a person who is more inclined to follow the Karmakanda section of the Vedas might say, if you ask him, well, what is the meaning of sacrifice? He would say demigod worship, because they are the suppliers of all these different material elements. But actually, the real understanding of the Vaishnavas that Srila Prabhupada is giving in the purport, this is what Prabhupada says in the purport, Therefore, ultimately, we have to depend on the production of the field and not on the production of big factories. The field production is due to sufficient rain from the sky. And such rains are controlled by demigods like Indra, Sun, Moon, etc. And they are all servants of the Lord. The Lord can be satisfied by sacrifices. Therefore, one who cannot perform them will find himself in scarcity. That is the law of nature. What is it? It's the law of nature. It's what Prabhupada is saying. So yajna, specifically, which yajna? The Sankirtan yajna, prescribed for this age, must therefore be performed to save us at least from scarcity of food supply. So please note carefully Srila Prabhupada's words. Sankirtan yajna prescribed for this age must therefore be performed to save us at least from the scarcity of food supply. So there's a side note here, it's very important to understand. What is the purpose of performing Sankirtan yajna? Is it to obtain food? No. The purpose of performing the Sankirtan yajna is to awaken our pure love of Godhead, is to awaken Krishna Prema. But obtaining the necessities of life, obtaining sufficient rain and food, is a natural byproduct of the Sankirtan yajna. So this is the law of nature, and the solution has also been given. We're in Kali Yuga and we're bound to face these types of circumstances, drought, absence of scarcity of food and so on. And the solution is right there. It's the Sankirtan yajna. It's the chanting of Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. It's the loud congregational chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra. So the next part of the purport is about taxation. And it's very interesting. Srila Prabhupada says, on the plea of relieving the suffering caused by the ensuing famine, the government will impose heavy taxes, especially on the wealthy mercantile community. So it's very interesting. This situation has come about because of ignorance. The governments, the leaders of society, aren't doing their duty, which is to educate people about the Sankirtan yajna. They're not actually performing their duty, which is to encourage the performance of Sankirtan. So they're clueless, they're misguided, and then the people are suffering. And then what do they say? They say, okay, now we're going to solve this problem of scarcity. How? By excessive taxation. So when they do this, what's the result? They go to Sara Mayadana. They go to the hellish planet as a result of doing that. So one may think, well, taxation, is it a wrong thing? Should it not be there? Is it a wrong practice on the part of leaders? But actually, Srila Prabhupada, in other parts of Srimad Bhagavatam, in his purports, he actually very clearly explains how taxation, how the king is meant to tax the citizens. So it's a very long purport, and I'll read excerpts from it. And if you have questions later on, then we can look at the other excerpts. So it's in 1st canto, 9th chapter, 27th shloka. And in that purport, Srila Prabhupada is going to such great lengths to describe the duties of a king. So he writes, Rajadharma is a great science, unlike modern diplomacy for political supremacy. So the kings were trained systematically to become munificent and not merely be tax collectors. So it's not just that the king's business is to impose taxes. There's a whole bunch of other things that they're meant to do that can qualify them to then start requesting taxes from the citizens. To lead the prajas, or in other words, the citizens, to the attainment of salvation was a great duty of the king. The father, the spiritual master, and the king are not to become irresponsible in the matter of leading their subjects to the path of ultimate liberation from birth, death, diseases, and old age. So the government's business is not just to levy taxes. It's to lead, it's to guide the citizens toward freedom from birth, old age, disease, and death. And then in the other parts of this paragraph, Srila Prabhupada is explaining how the kings will work, must work under the guidance of the Brahmanas. And the Brahmanas themselves are thoroughly well versed in the Dharma Shastras, so they actually tell the kings how to run the kingdom. And then Srila Prabhupada explains this in detail. He says, the taxation law was simple. There was no force, no encroachment. How many people nowadays are joyfully paying their taxes to the government? How many of you pay taxes? Yeah, some of you have to pay taxes. And do you do this with a blissful heart? You know, do you feel good about this? I'm going to pay my taxes. I'm going to give even more. You know, so, you know what you're asking is not. I love the government so much, I'll give even more. Who does this? Nobody. But Prabhupada is saying here that previously there was no force, no encroachment. The king had a right to take 1/4 of the production made by the subject. So whatever was produced, the maximum amount of taxation that could be imposed was 25%, not more than that. In addition, the king had a right to claim 1/4 of whatever wealth the subject allotted for charity or spent for some other purpose. So production was taxed 25%, and then the other types of activities like charity or some other types of spending could also be taxed additionally. And this is very interesting. If you hear this, one would never grudge parting with it. Why? So the citizens would not pay their taxes grudgingly. They would happily pay the taxes. Why was that the case? Because due to the pious king and religious harmony, there was enough natural wealth, namely grains, fruits, flowers, silk, cotton, milk, jewels, minerals, etc. And therefore, no one was materially unhappy. The citizens were rich in agriculture and animal husbandry, and therefore they had enough grains, fruits and milk without any artificial needs of soaps and toilets, cinemas and bars, is what Srila Prabhupada is saying. So they were very happy to pay the taxes to the king. Why? Because they had ample supply of everything they needed. And why did they have ample supply? Because the king was pious. The king was religious. He was guiding everyone properly. So there was an abundance of everything that was needed. Nobody had any problem paying taxes. So we're very, very far from that situation today. And I mean, this is not even the entire purport. There's so many other duties of the king, like protecting the tapasvis and so on, protecting the illiterate, women, the uneducated, the poor. The king had so many other duties. The king would factually protect the citizens, and he could levy taxes. And then nobody had a problem with that, because they actually felt protected, they felt secure. Nobody felt that they were being exploited. So, laws of nature. We're talking about laws of nature. And it's becoming very clear that if one wants to avoid suffering, they need to understand spiritual and material laws. They need to understand the need for worship of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. They need to understand the need for sacrifice, yajna. And in this age, it is the Sankirtan yajna. And it's very clear that if countries are run in the way being described here in Srila Prabhupada's purport, the result will be there. If you follow what is in the Shastra, you get the result. And if you don't follow, you don't get the result. And if you follow 50%, you get 50% of the result. You follow 60%, you get 60% of the result. This is how it works. So, I was thinking about this when I read all this and I read the purport. I was thinking, well, how is this relevant to us who are sitting in Bhagavatam class? We're hearing about how kings should run the country. We're hearing about the importance of propagation of the Sankirtan Yajna. We're hearing about how the king should actually do this and how he should tax the citizens and so on. And what does this have to do with us is the question. What's the relevance to us who are sitting here? Actually, there's a reason why Srila Prabhupada wrote all this in his purports. Srila Prabhupada, he gave up sleep to write his books. Why? Because these instructions are for us. This Srila Prabhupada is giving us service. What is our service? We have a 10,000-year project. This vision is there in Prabhupada's purports. And his desire is that this manifests in the world. Now, it might seem very overwhelming. How do we do this? You know, it's like, what are the chances of us being able to accomplish that? Is this utopian? No, it's not utopian. If it were utopian, Prabhupada wouldn't have taken the trouble to write these things down in his purports. This is not utopia, it is service. And with service, with the instruction, comes the empowerment to accomplish it. So if each and every single devotee begins to take Srila Prabhupada's purport seriously and begins to understand that I have a personal obligation to serve the interest of Prabhupada, you're going to start seeing changes happen very, very fast. It's a matter of understanding how meaningful it is for us, how relevant it is for us. It is the instruction of the founder Acharya. So, how will this change come about? You know, what are we going to do? Should we go to Delhi and overthrow the government and, you know, put ourselves in position? How is this going to happen? This change is going to happen from the bottom. We didn't read this from the purport we were reading earlier. It's a very long purport, but actually Srila Prabhupada also speaks about that. He says, right now what we are dealing with is a government by the people, for the people, of the people as well. So it means you have a whole bunch of misguided people, an entire misguided population, and then they vote another misguided fellow into power. And the system itself is such that if he wants to remain in power, which actually tends to be his foremost concern, then he has to satisfy a whole bunch of misguided people. So how he's going to satisfy a bunch of misguided people is by actually further doing things that in the end actually make their condition worse. So Prabhupada said that this was not the system. This was not the system. The system is that a qualified king selects his representatives, his ministers, and so on. And because he's a qualified king, he knows what is to be done. An autocratic system. So, how do we manifest this vision of Prabhupada? The change comes from the bottom. Because the existing situation, the status quo, is democracy. It's a voting system. So therefore, what you need is a majority of the population who are intelligent enough to vote a Vaishnava into power. And it seems like such a big job, because it basically means that the majority of the population must be intelligent enough, must be God-conscious enough, that they realize the importance of putting a qualified leader in place. Once that happens, and once people have faith in the Bhagavatam, then the system itself can be changed. You know, then we may not need democracy anymore, because people will start to understand Bhagavatam is right. you know, this system of voting is not a very efficient way of getting things done. Let's just follow how things are in the Bhagavatam and in Prabhupada's purports. But before that happens, you're going to need the mass of the population to come to their senses. So it seems overwhelming. It seems, my God, how do we do this? Okay, it's a 10,000 year project. We all have our part to play in it. But it is the instruction. And if it is the instruction, it means we have our homework to do. We have our bit to do. The distribution of Srila Prabhupada's books, the propagation of the Harinam Sankirtan Yagya, you know, all these things will help to gradually turn things around. And I was thinking, when I was reading this, that is there a real example of having been able to turn things around on a mass scale, on a large scale? And somehow I remembered the and this is a case, a case study, you can say, not of a previous yuga, but of Kali Yuga. It actually works. In Kali Yuga, they actually did manage to do this. Who was the king who managed to do this? His name was King Birambir. So the story is that Srinivas Acharya, Narottam Das Thakur, and Shyamananda Pandit, they were studying in Vrindavan under Jiva Goswami. And then the assignment was given to them to distribute the literatures written by the Goswamis in Bengal and in other parts of India, Bengal and Orissa. So they were the very first traveling Sankirtan party. And at the time there was no printing press. Everything was handwritten. And if copies of the books were made, they were made by hand on palm leaves. So these were very carefully packed. Jiva Goswami packed them very carefully. He put them in a chest, like a treasure chest. And he wrapped that treasure chest very carefully in wax cloth, so these writings would be protected. And a party was sent of 10 guards and 4 strong bullocks to pull the cart, a very spacious cart. And all these books were kept. And the 3 acharyas, Narottam Das Thakur, Srinivas Acharya, and Shyamananda Pandit, they started off to Bengal. And they followed the route. They left Vrindavan, they went to Mathura, and then Agra, and then another place called Itar. It's very interesting. I was thinking maybe that's the place called Itarshi, actually. When you're traveling by train, it's one of the stops. So a few places like this. Until eventually, before arriving in Bengal, they came upon a kingdom of the Mala kings. This kingdom's name was Vanavishnupur. And the king, his name was Maharaj Birambir. But he was a leader of bandits. His entire his team, he had a team of bandits, and his business was to actually plunder the travelers. So it's interesting because his business was to plunder. That's how he maintained his kingdom. And his destination would have been this particular hellish planet. But what happened was the king would regularly consult his astrologers. And his astrologers once told him that as these acharyas were passing by, the astrologers predicted that there is an invaluable treasure that is coming very close to your kingdom. The price of this treasure cannot be estimated. There is no limit to the price of this treasure. So the king became very interested. Said, "Well, what is this?" So he sent his team of gundas, bandits, to actually follow these acharyas and see what they were doing. So at night, when they camped nearby a lake, these thieves came and they stole all the Goswami's books. And as we're saying, you know, in those days, it's not like there were backup copies saved on your external hard drive, you know, electronic versions of the Shastra. Those were the only copies available. So they were all very distressed. And what happened? Srinivasacharya said to Narottam Das Thakur, because he was more senior, he asked them to carry on. He said, you go ahead, both of you go ahead, and somehow or other continue to preach, even though we don't have the books, but preach what we learnt from, you know, our spiritual masters. So you go to Bengal and Orissa and preach. And he said, I'll stay behind and I'll search for these manuscripts, I'll search for these sacred texts. So he stayed in the area of Vanavishnupur, but he didn't know exactly where the books were. So gradually he became friends with one Brahmana, Krishna Vallabha, his name was, who lived in the neighboring area. And as they became friends, this Brahmana said, you know, there is a very regular daily Bhagavatam recitation in the court of the king. So would you be interested in going to hear this? So Srinivasacharya said, yes, let's go hear Bhagavatam. So they went into the king's court. And the king had a priest who recited the Bhagavatam. This priest's name was Vyasacharya. But when he recited the Srimad Bhagavatam, it wasn't with reference to the commentaries of Sridhar Swami and other authorized acharyas and commentators. He was making up his own interpretation. He was concocting the meaning of what was in the 10th canto. He was very fond of speaking of the Rasa Leela, but he was speaking things that didn't make sense. So Srinivasacharya wasn't impressed. He was thinking, what is this, you know? So after 2 weeks of hearing, he challenged. He said, my dear sir, what you're speaking is completely, you know, you're making things up, you're making stories up. So the king became very curious. He said, oh, you're challenging my priest, so why don't you come and speak on the Bhagavatam? So then Srinivasacharya began to speak on the Bhagavatam, and his potency was so strong that simply hearing him recite the Bhagavatam and explain the verses, everybody in the king's court experienced a change of heart. And actually the king himself had experienced a change of heart even before that, because when he opened the chest, he saw the books of the Goswamis. He picked up the first book and he saw the signature of Srila Rupa Goswami. Just by touching the book, he started experiencing remorse, a change of heart, and he realized he made a big mistake. So, and later on the king, in a dream, he had a dream of a very effulgent personality who came and said, I will deliver you from all your sinful reactions, do not fear. I will come to you to recuperate my manuscript. So when the king heard Srinivasacharya speak, he became completely enamored by Srinivasacharya. He invited him to stay in his with him in his palace. And at night he could hear, because his room was next to Srinivasacharya's room, he could hear that Srinivasacharya wouldn't sleep. He would just keep chanting all night long. And then the king understood, this is a great personality, I need to surrender to this person. So the king eventually, like this, became a disciple of Srinivasacharya. And he asked him, what service can I do for you? And Srinivasacharya said, we lost some books. These books were stolen. And the king said, he began to beg forgiveness. He said, actually, I am the culprit. I am the guilty person. I am the one who stole these books. So here you are. He returned the books to them, to Srinivasacharya. And later on, the king was initiated. He became a disciple of Srinivasacharya. And what did he do after he became a disciple of Srinivasacharya? He made it compulsory in his kingdom for everybody to chant the holy name. And if someone didn't chant the holy name, it was punishable by law. This king, by association with Srinivasacharya, had such a change of heart. He was a leader of bandits. He was a plunderer. He was going to go to this place, Sarumayadana. And now he turned everything around and he became a king, and he made it the law in his kingdom that everybody should chant japa. And if you do not chant japa, you have to leave the kingdom. Not only that, his descendants also maintained that. It's described that the kings who are his descendants, they would disguise themselves to go and spy on the citizens, to see Are the citizens chanting japa or are they not chanting japa? When did this happen? 17th century. It wasn't 5,000 years ago. This happened in this yuga, 17th century, a few hundred years ago. A king who converted his entire kingdom to Vaishnavism, who protected the citizens, who made it compulsory to worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead by chanting the holy names. So it is possible, it was done, it has been done in this yuga, and therefore it can be done again. Why? Because it is the instruction of the founder Acharya. So it's happened already in Kali Yuga, it can be done again. It is just a matter of being empowered. When one is thoroughly connected to the Guru Parampara, he is connected to Srila Prabhupada, he is connected to Srinivas Acharya. So, what we need to meditate on is how is my personal connection with the Guru Parampara? You know? Is my connection with the Guru Parampara deep? Or is it official? The deeper the connection, the more we become free from aparadas and anarthas, the more empowered we can become by the entire Guru Parampara and by Krishna himself and by the holy names who are non different from Krishna, Abhinatva Nama Namino. So empowerment is there, it's possible, it happened before, it happened recently, it can be done again. So thank you very much for your kind attention. We're a few, 5 minutes over time. And we won't be able to take questions and answers, unfortunately. But thank you very much for your patience. Prantara Srimad Bhagavatam ki. Srila Prabhupada ki.
So we should become kings. Huh?